Welcome to the East Traumacast. This program was brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Advancing science, fostering relationships, and building careers. Now, on to the Traumacast.
Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to Haemonetics for their generous and unrestricted grant for the Educational Resources Committee and Traumacast. I'm Lauren Dudas, acute care surgeon from West Virginia University. Today, we're going to talk about a topic we haven't covered in the past, injury control and violence prevention. I have one of our East committee members here with me, and we have a very special panelist of guests. So I'm going to let everyone introduce themselves.
Hey, my name is Hillary Prince. I'm a trauma acute care surgeon at Parkland Memorial Hospital in UT Southwestern in Dallas. I am also a member of the Injury Control Violence Prevention Committee at East, which I've been fortunate enough to work with a lot of great people around the country on projects like this. And we're very excited to have our three panel members with us today.
Hi, everyone. Courtney Edwards, and I am the Injury Prevention Professional at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas.
Hi, I'm Mary Lobby. I am the Adult Injury Prevention Coordinator for UW Health's Level 1 Adult Trauma Center.
My name is Jill Brazelton. I am the executive director for the Think First National Injury Prevention Foundation.
So Hillary, why don't you tell us a little bit about how this Traumacast even came about?
I think this really came about because, as you know, there's a group of faculty around the country that are part of our ICBP committee. And as each of us tried to talk about each of our center's efforts in injury control and violence prevention, you know, we all know the East National event at the annual assembly, but very few of us actually knew what was happening at our own centers. And I came to Courtney at this point, who's our coordinator at Parkland, and said, you know, what in the world do we do all the time in order to meet our requirements for being a level one trauma center? And she's constantly doing 8,000 things and on a million committees. And all of us, sort of as any of the MDs that were present on the call, really had no clue as to exactly how all these activities were organized and who runs them and how we reach out to the community and things like that. So we thought perhaps it wasn't just us, that maybe it was a nationwide issue, and we could discuss that for, you know, junior faculty or fellows coming out of training or things like that, since we don't get any formal education regarding that topic.
What are the requirements for level one trauma center, and how are they going to differ between less high volume trauma centers?
So I would say this falls into Mary and I's purview as to what we are going through. Just completed my fourth survey as the injury prevention professional for a level one center with the American College of Surgeons. Mary's going through her preparation right now, and so she can attest to that. But for the regards for injury prevention, this has kind of been something that, as a person who works in this realm, has caused me to bang my head against the wall a few times, because the gray book is better than the orange book, which is about the same as the green book, which was about the same as the yellow book. And that's as far back as I go. But, you know, it really says that there has to be a person, can't be the same person as a trauma program manager, but there just has to be a person, and they have to use their trauma registry. Now we say, and some of the other regional data, and you have to do two programs. Doesn't necessarily specify anything about the programs or that they should really be based in the evidence and that they really should be tailored to your patient population. It kind of alludes to that, and that you should focus on partnerships. And I will admit that I'm really happy with the way the gray book took some more steps in the right direction than the orange book did or the green book did, because as injury prevention professionals, these regulations, these guidelines, these stipulations are what really kind of give me power with my administration to say this work is important and what I do has value, because I'm always having to justify that and always begging and pleading that, you know, what we do is just as important as what happens in the trauma resuscitation room.
Thank you, Courtney. Great overview. And I think the only thing I would add to that is to drill down a little bit on some of those requirements from ACS, including that we're focusing, looking at at-risk populations specifically, which is, I would say, in some ways a refinement of the data piece, because just looking at regional and trauma registry data doesn't necessarily get us at the at-risk population. So underneath that, part of what I mean is also understanding things like social determinants of health, understanding health disparities, even disaggregating that data by race and ethnicity to really be able to see those disparities in a different way, right? And the other piece is, and to your point about giving you a little bit of power behind some of the vagueness, I guess, with our own separate administrations, is a requirement that there is support from leadership for this work and investment, which doesn't automatically happen. So being able to, I mean, and I say that from having, and I'm sure you have too, Courtney, talk to other coordinators for injury prevention programs that, that get a little frustrated at how to get some traction. So those would be the other things I would add to that.
Tell us a little bit about your backgrounds, what drew you to injury prevention, and then are there specific criteria for this person, quote unquote, as named in the gray book?
So I started in this position in March of 2019, which means I had a year in this role before COVID struck us all and made us all have to do everything we do differently, which made injury prevention work also very interesting because much of what we do is with people in, I mean, and so does everyone else, but and with our community partners. So there was a lot of quick pivoting that also happened in the injury prevention world. My background is sexual and domestic violence policy and prevention. I was a state coalition director in two different states for a very long time. This role was my first role with healthcare on the inside of healthcare. On the outside of healthcare, I was very much an advocate and sometimes agitator, depending on where I was, with looking for policy and practice change with regard to sexual and domestic violence. But because of that work, historically for me as a lobbyist, literally at the state and the national level, and developing policy and practice and training agendas, both at the local and state level with policymakers and systems, it also gave me a great foundation for walking into this job, which has been, honestly, despite it being very challenging in many ways, it's also been a delight because everything I've done has given me a good foundation for both working with those community partners, understanding policy, understanding systems and administrations in a way that let me navigate what would otherwise have been, I think, and still is some days overwhelming because things aren't always clear. And when you're in a very large institution, as we are here, and Courtney is, it is not always clear where the doors to different silos open and close. So that background served me well to walk into this job and sort of hit the road running.
So Mary highlights one side of the way people come into injury prevention for hospital systems. I'm kind of your other. I was a trauma nurse, not to brag. I was a really good trauma nurse. And one day my medical director and trauma program manager cornered me into the corner of a room and said, Courtney, we think you should do this. And I'm like, no, I'm a nurse. I take care of patients. And they're like, no, Courtney, you're going to do this. We need you to move forward. We have to fill this position. And our old injury prevention person is moving on to different things. And I'm like, okay, great. Fabulous. I know nothing about public health or injury prevention. I am a nurse. I am an ER ICU background nurse, trauma. What do I know about that? And then so I'm kind of a bit of a little nerd. And so the first thing was, I was like, all right, well, you guys have to support me in this. And we're like, and my medical director, he's like, yes, Courtney, you go back to school. And I'm like, okay. And so I went back and got my master's in public health to learn about the public health realm and what that means and appreciate that. Because as a clinician, I didn't initially get that. I probably got a little bit more than some. I think we had one semester class for public health, and in that was a little injury prevention. And then I knew what I knew from taking care of trauma patients and teaching in the community and stuff like that, but not really understanding and appreciating injury and violence prevention. And so I went back to school, got my master's in public health, grew and adopted and really figured out how they kind of all merged together. and can mirror. And that's sometimes one of the things. That's why some of the work that I've done over the years in trying to create that foundation and build up injury prevention professionals across the nation and through Texas is that appreciation and that merging of hospital-based initiatives and hospital-based injury and violence prevention with the public health approach. This is one of the things that I think we're still growing in and still working towards, is that partnership and that collaboration that's coming together that's really been evident over the past several years, but even more so.
Think back to when you guys first started these positions. How did you first really start to get engaged? Because we may have some listeners that they are listening to this because their institution is behind on their criteria, or they are just getting into the position and may need some help. So imagine back to when you first started and what was the first couple steps?
So I think where you can be successful in moving into the role for an injury prevention professional, for a hospital-based, for within a trauma center, you need to really find a mentor and find someone that can hold your hand. There's many across the nation. I got involved in a professional organization, Safe States Alliance, which is a predominantly public health, but they have expanded over the past years. They have a hospital-based injury prevention. They call them the SIG, which is HIP-SIG. And so that's, you know, Mary and I know each other through there from some of the ties, because it does merge that information and help blur those lines together. For if you're at a level one or level two trauma center, a resource guide that is really important to you is what's called the standards and indicators for model level one and two trauma centers. This is a document that talks about really some of the pillars of injury prevention, how to get there. There's some references, resources, where you can go about that to get it together. And then ironically, there is now a new textbook that just came out. They call it a textbook. It's not really a textbook. It's kind of like a resource manual. But Dr. Tinkoff is one of the, Glenn Tinkoff is one of the editors for it. And it's hospital-based injury and violence prevention programs. Those are some of the, like, if you're a reader or a great resource, professional organizations, of course, East, you have the injury committee there. I think most of the professional organizations have injury as a focus, prevention, that they're moving forward. The Trauma Prevention Coalition is a great resource as well. And there's a lot of education, free education, that's out there on how to do injury and violence prevention, how to mirror that public health. You just kind of have to know where to look. And sometimes that's where calling a friend can really be helpful.
So I appreciate you making reference to those documents. I had lived in this community for a very long time and started my professional life here. And then I left for close to 15 years and came back, and I no longer knew anyone here who were, you know, the people I had been working with had moved on to other places. So I undertook a prevention inventory of both the community and UW Health, and went and talked to anyone who would talk to me in the community. And I would say that's where, in some ways, some of my background in having been here previously in the nonprofit universe and policy arena, the doors opened pretty quickly, partly because they weren't used to people asking to talk to them from where I was working from. And so I had a series of questions that I asked everyone. And from that, I got a very good idea about what was going on, where prevention work was occurring in terms of injury prevention and violence prevention, who was doing it, how they were doing it, who was doing evidence-based work, where the research partners existed and didn't, and mostly they didn't, and who had partnerships with healthcare and who didn't. I asked about trauma-informed care and who was doing both trauma treatment programming, but also who was investing in trauma, vicarious trauma prevention, because lots of the organization I was speaking with were crisis-based organizations who were doing injury prevention and violence prevention work. And then I came to UW Health and went across the system and asked everyone the same sort of questions. And from that, I developed my strategic plan and wrote what ended up being about an 18-page document that laid out what I thought I should do and why I should do it, including the data that I had culled from both the trauma registry and the community. And from that, I also developed a logic model, which gave the basis for being able to evaluate this program I was laying out in front of everyone, which I have been using as the evaluation metrics and evaluation plan, which, and one of the reasons I'm mentioning that right now is because I would say laying something like that out for yourself puts you in good stead for that next trauma re-verification, because you are documenting as you go what you're doing, what you've been doing, why you've been doing it, and the measures for it. So that's where I started. And it's been very useful for a lot of reasons and has led to some successes that I'm not so sure would have happened otherwise, including several of the issues that I work on that are priorities in my work being identified as community health needs assessment priorities and adopted recently by our own system as priorities. So that's been a very pleasant surprise.
I would say for me, my background being in a health professional organization right now that provides injury prevention education to health systems, to trauma centers, I came from a role where I was an injury prevention coordinator for 15 years doing programs in the community. And what helped me grow was really networking with other professionals that were doing the programs to understand, how could I do this better? How could I expand programming to, you know, from moving from school age children to falls prevention, to car seats, to whatever it was, really working and networking with people. And like Courtney said, finding a mentor that is doing what you need to do. And of course, aligning with what your health system would like you to do as well. That's where Think First has been really helpful, because we have a big network of chapters.
I would add one other important thing that was, I think, fairly important for me, which was that our medical director is an MPH. And from the day I walked in the door, it was made very clear that prevention was important to her. And then, you know, there were other surgeons who were doing things in the community, whether it was, you know, investing in Stop the Bleed programs or other things. So they became very supportive allies in the work I was trying to do and have been all along. And they often will, you know, I don't ask them to do a lot, but when I do, they're very quick to say yes. So whether it's doing a presentation for me somewhere or being a part of a webinar or lots of interviews with media, they're always supportive in that. So I think finding those MPHs as well who understand and often are teaching the prevention class somewhere.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Mary, because for me personally too, having that partnership with your physician colleagues, whether it's your medical director or one of your trauma surgeons like Hillary, is so important, because, you know, that Dr. White coat means a lot. I mean, I have a nurse doctor title. Doesn't mean as much as Hillary's title and what she can do and how important and critical that is. And so I just stress that anyone listening, have a conversation, have coffee with your injury prevention specialist, professional coordinator, get to know them, because that partnership, when the two of you team together, is a powerful force to be reckoned with. I did some work research over what happened during COVID with injury prevention and the people, the programming, the whole kit and caboodle. And we had information from 227 trauma centers across the United States. And we talked about staff getting laid off, programs being redirected to validate evidence-based programs, but now into a virtual setting, and how we could continue moving this forward because the work is so important. And I heard stories about medical directors advocating and trauma surgeons advocating for their injury prevention professionals so they don't get furloughed, so they didn't get reallocated in their roles and responsibilities. Because, you know, all in all, there is a lot of inequity and limited prioritization in the world of injury and violence prevention, and we need to keep that central and focused. And so I agree, that partnership, gosh, if you can get a good one going, that's a force to be reckoned with.
So Mary had talked about taking an inventory of sort of her local resources. I know Courtney has dug into probably every resource imaginable for Dallas and our surrounding area and honestly across the country. How do you then determine who the best partners in the community are for our institutions, and how and what barriers have you encountered, barriers to helping those programs grow and partner with us?
Well, there are a few things. So one is, I think you can tell pretty easily if people are collaborators or not. I would just, start there. And by that, I mean, is there a partnership where, are people looking for a partnership, first of all, or are they really sole practitioners in the work that they're doing? And some are and want to be, and, so that's fine. But then they're not going to be great partners because, frankly, part of what I bring to a partnership like that is reinterpreting what they're doing for the universe I work in, or informing about trends I might be seeing that are of use to them. And an example there might be sitting on a opioid fatality review team and being able to talk about practices and policies you see at play that might be contradictory to what they're seeing in the reality of who's actually dying from opioid overdoses. So in that case, there's a real interest in sharing information about the universes we each represent. Somebody else might be very interested in building partnerships for the sake of resource sharing in every possible way. And again, they are probably, and the example I would give there for me is our statewide, the Wisconsin Institute on Healthy Aging, which is our sort of brain trust on older adult falls prevention. They very much want engagement with the healthcare and medical community because, for all the reasons we can imagine, every adult trauma center has, probably the majority of their patients everywhere, like us, are people who've fallen. So it's a magical partnership in a lot of ways. The places that aren't are those that might just hold their cards too close and really don't feel that we have something to offer or that they have anything to offer us. And I don't even know that I have a very good example of that, except sometimes government can be that way. And that is like the only experience I have of finding that, where they really want to lead and not share. I don't have a lot to either give them or provide or contribute to even the universe I work in. The other thing I would say is where you happen to be. Dallas is a much bigger community than Madison, Wisconsin. We have a large healthcare system, but we live in a small community. So we don't have 10 different agencies working on each issue. So we have a primary gun violence provider that is our partner. We have a primary falls prevention local community partner that is our partner. And I'm very fortunate. These are fabulous partners who do really good work and want to do the best work they can. So that makes my job very easy. And there aren't many that, there are very few issues for which we have multiple partners here. And those we have, again, I feel lucky that we have leaders in those partnerships who know how to collaborate. And that has not been true everywhere I've worked. So again, I just feel fortunate, but those are the things I'd be looking for. Are people collaborative? Because I don't run a lot of programs, I contribute to a lot of things.
I think what you said at the very end is so important. As hospital-based injury and violence prevention, we don't necessarily run a lot of programs, but we contribute to the success of a whole lot of our community programs. Because most of your trauma centers across the nation, your hospital-based injury prevention affiliated with your trauma center is a person of one, and maybe not a full one at that. They may do injury prevention and outreach education, or they're the PI coordinator plus also injury prevention. We see the ampersand used a lot in our roles. Yeah, what about FreeMU from the community collaborative standpoint?
So tell us how you work with institutions to make sure that you can have that partnership to be beneficial to the institution, your organization, and the community.
So Think First is a standalone injury prevention foundation, and we have the materials that we partner with hospitals to become chapters of Think First. And then the hospital system staff, whoever that may be, will go into the community and do the programs. We partnered with East this past meeting to be part of the community outreach event. And we did this trauma survivor section. And so it was exciting to be part of that and to actually be in the community realm. With all of our Think First chapters, I would say the majority of the coordinators, the health injury prevention professionals are the ones actually doing the programming in the community. And even with the larger health systems, Courtney, as you mentioned, you and Mary too, you partner with a lot of people, but there are locations where they have people that are the boots on the ground out doing programs. And it really depends on what your programs are. You know, if your focus is falls prevention, for example, you know, if you don't have a community partner that can do that for you, the Think First programs actually have all the pieces that you need. It's a kit, per se, of, you know, PowerPoint scripts, how to get into a community, where do you start, a little bit of mentoring too. So I'm kind of on a different side of it. And having come from the injury prevention professional role to this, I get to see both sides. Would love to partner with hospitals, but we, you know, we have chapters all across the country. We probably have about 120 chapters. I would say the majority of them are within health systems and hospitals.
And Jill, as somebody who's seen kind of both sides, you know, from both perspectives of being a community partner as well as being the injury prevention coordinator at a big center, do you feel like there are any specific barriers that you've had to overcome? Are there any specific challenges you faced from one side or the other that you feel like you could sort of coach new people to this in order to get past?
Well, I think for me, and of course, I'm coming from a Think First background. When you're starting a program, oftentimes you're looking for lots of information on what is the best, how can I do this, how can I reach this need, whether it's you see something in your community. What has been helpful for me was having the tools kind of already there, and I have this kit that I can put together and modify. For example, if I'm going to be working with non-English speaking community, I can work with the translator to adapt to what's needed there. I think having the tools and the resources to make it appropriate for who I'm talking to was really helpful, both, you know, as a coordinator myself, and then from this end, really looking and seeing how can we make our programs adaptable for all communities, whether it's tribal community or, you know, an inner city, so that it can be used across the board for any injury prevention program. And I think that was the biggest thing for me, was trying to make it appropriate for all people groups. And, you know, in today's world, we see that there's big discrepancies. So making sure we're reaching all the people that need to be reached in a voice that can be understood by the people that you're trying to educate or give them the information.
And as we think about our residents, our fellows, our other levels of trainee, as well as junior faculty, how can those people who have an interest in this field but really have no idea how to make an impact in this field, how can we be of most help and use to you all? How should we sort of engage on this side? What are the best things we could do to contribute to everyone's efforts? Courtney's laughing at me because I literally made her give me like a 3-hour dissertation on this topic one day, and I still am, you know, trying to work through it. But how can, like you said, we have the white coat, we have the title. If we want to get that out there and have it do some good, what's the best way we can do that?
So you can come to my office anytime and I will give you another 3-hour dissertation. That's exactly what we need. Come to us. Ask us, what are you working on? What is a priority to you, to the organization? Because I try to mirror my injury prevention as much to my hospital's CHNA, needs assessment, and everything else, so that way I can get buy-in. What's important to you? What are you all working on? I had a resident fellow that was very interested in intimate partner violence, but I had just spent 2 years meeting with all the stakeholders in our areas. We got a validated tool. We built it into Epic. We had done all this training with the nursing staff. We had flipped their workflow because now their intimate partner screening is tied with human trafficking and neglect, but it's not occurring in triage. It's now occurring in the care area within the pods of the ER and then within the clinics and the jail health clinic. And I had spent 2 years doing this. And she walks in, wants to change everything and do this research project. And I was like, no, please don't touch anything. Don't talk about it. Don't look at it. Don't do anything. Because we had worked so hard from so many people and so many levels on that very project. And I'm like, you want to do intimate partner violence? Let's take it this direction and look at this segment of the population that I know we're, because of what we've already done, we're getting data back, we're under hitting this area. Let's refine this and work with it. That's what I appreciate. And then we can partner together and be much more effective in what we're working together because they, you know, the medical students, the fellows, the residents, I appreciate and welcome everyone's passion and resilience. We just don't need to work against each other. There's so little resources and so few of us who care about injury and violence prevention.
Everything Courtney said, and you know, for those of us who are fortunate enough to work in an academic medical center and have access to MPH students or medical students, I think being a preceptor is a great way to get people involved. And to your point, Courtney, it has to be the things I'm working on. I mean, we have enough to do, right? I can't help people on things that aren't priorities in my own bucket at this point. So I do let them know what I'm working on and would be happy to get help with. And so this semester, I have a fourth year medical student who's doing his, you know, whatever it ends up being, I think it's 120, 200 hour placement within a very concentrated period of time, working on helping to develop an aftercare and a recovery program designed for our gun violence community partnership. So for our hospital violence linked intervention program, which is a tremendous help. In my mind, one of the things I'm getting excited about is that he is going to take this passion with him into his, he's going into emergency medicine rather. And for the last several years, I've had MPH students who have been working on a trauma-informed culture initiative for us across our system, and more recently on an intimate partner violence project. So yes, they have been, in most cases, been very helpful. In some, you know, the other thing is that they understand that, you know, we don't control everything. So if something else is going to pop up and take precedent over what it is we're working on, or we've run into a barrier, I can't always fix everything in their placement timeframe, which has also happened. And so we pivot, but that's also a good life experience for them because there's so much that pops up in the middle of all of our work and their future work that will, that they'll need to contend with. And mostly I found that to be only valuable. I think the other piece, you know, it depends on how advocacy oriented I think a given system is. So I am about to be working with a group of young pediatrics faculty who are very interested in gun violence prevention, and they're calling themselves the Gun Violence Prevention Advocacy Group in the School of Medicine. They think it can happen overnight, and policy doesn't work that way. It's a very slow, long game. But I can at least talk about what that looks like. So I think that's the other thing, is looking for those passion pieces that happen to be bubbling up across the system. And sometimes it's pretty obvious where they're going to happen. Or people at this point know where to find me. That's the other thing that will happen, is people will, you know, Courtney said, show up in her office and be interested in something or looking for something to do. So that would be the other thing I would say.
Do you guys ever have to worry about funding, or do you get money from your institution or national grants, or zero? Mary's saying zero. Courtney's saying zero.
Because our community health needs assessment led to a large and wide array of priorities, including several adult injury prevention priorities that included gun violence prevention, intimate partner violence, and older adult falls, among other things, suicide, addiction, And so the first three I mentioned are in fact getting a broad level of support from other departments, our population health department, that is a very active, progressive department of UW Health that is supporting this, and our leadership has supported it. So what that looks like financially, I'm not sure yet, but you know, up until now, there has been support from population health, but, and most of the support, I think appropriately, also has gone to our community partners, and increasingly so. So that is another huge benefit to the work I do, because as Courtney and I both said, the work happens in the community. And so being able to support that work financially from our institution makes the work happen faster and more easily, and allows people to be more nimble in pivoting toward emerging issues.
Yeah, I don't have a dedicated budget for injury and violence prevention within the hospital. Where we do get some funding is through the general trauma budget. I have access to that, and we can use some of that for some of the things like purchasing new training equipment for Stop the Bleed or different initiatives that we might be going through. I have a fabulous foundation that I get the opportunity to work with. So our foundation is kind of our fundraising group outside of the hospital that helps support the hospital and many of the hospital initiatives. And like Mary said, just partnering with other departments, organizations, how can we do this? And lots of times it's, you know, really getting creative about where we can pull together and scrap together little bits of resources to really create something that you can do. Yeah, that's always a concern. And I would say it's pretty universal.
What are some of the national resources that are available? We talked about local, community, regional. And then if somebody wants to take the position into policy and advocacy, is that something that is within the realm of your position, or would that be beyond it?
I'm going to start this in a slightly different place because I feel like it hasn't been said yet, and then it'll make sense to slide into that. So we've talked about partnerships, and I think the thing we haven't so much talked about is local, regional, and state networking and committees and organizations, as well as those national groups and our local partners, because that is the other place to find your colleagues. So for us in Wisconsin, we do have a statewide trauma advisory council, and there is now an injury prevention committee of that trauma council. So we are connecting with all of the trauma centers, injury prevention folks, most of whom are not able to be full-time because they're not level one trauma centers. They have other jobs. That there are also, again, other state and national organizations that make this otherwise what could be a fairly lonely role, because you're the only one doing that work in sometimes large health systems, a little less lonely because you have colleagues and peers that are both faced with the same obstacles or problems or issues that you're faced with and can work through them. Because for, you know, probably any discipline, it is your peers that can be the most supportive and help you move through things.
So we don't say advocacy, we say education a lot. And we educate our county commissioners, we educate our lawyers, we educate our mayors, we educate our state representatives. Yeah, I've testified before our state representatives for a Stop the Bleed initiative to get Stop the Bleed training kits in all of our schools and mandate education. I worked with our mayor and our city council about the electric scooters and injuries that we had from electric scooters, you know, and I work with our county commissioners for alcohol-related crashes. So yeah, absolutely, this is a huge role. And this is actually the role where I most value my physician counterparts a lot. To get them to engage in those conversations as well is super powerful. And the healthcare community, the physician community, is massively powerful. I mean, look what we've managed to achieve from the Medical Firearms Summit, with individuals coming together, practitioners coming together, organizations coming together that are really trying to improve the communities in which we really live, work, and play every single day.
I would just say from a national perspective, from a national office, we do advocate, but really through our chapters. And that's really by educating the people that are in your communities. And if something comes up, you know, whether it's a primary seatbelt law or a helmet law or whatever it may be, our chapters will support our chapters with information to help educate, to really be able to advocate for those changes that need to be made.
You know, depending on what it is that's happening, we might call it advocacy or we might call it education. And we, like probably most institutions, do have a government affairs person and a lobbyist, both. And we have two. We have one that is focused at the local level in a government affairs role, and someone at the state and federal level. And they're very accessible. And they, I mean, the thing that they know that becomes really important is whether anything is even worthwhile trying. And I don't mean to sound quite that defeatist, because I don't mean it that way. But if you know, and they do know, what the response to something is going to be, and if it is going to be an absolute no to an idea that is being put forth, then all you're going to do is lose, you know, some of the chips you may have to play with by bringing something like that forward. And we can all easily think of what those things are, depending on the state you're in. When I said sometimes it is advocacy, I'm thinking about times when we have the trauma department and the emergency department together move forward in advocating for funding for one of our partners that was going to lose funding for a political reason, not for another reason. And seeing those names on a letter that goes to a local government agency that this institution and many surgeons and physicians and others are signing onto a letter saying, these are the reasons we need this agency to continue to exist, is a pretty powerful position to take. And that happens too, and can happen and needs to happen sometime.
I think a lot of what we're hearing is that, you know, collaborating with our injury prevention, violence prevention professionals is the most important thing we can do, instead of, you know, separating off and trying to do other things. Just make sure that we're collaborating within our institution and adding, not subtracting, essentially, from all of the efforts that have gone on before us. There's no need for us to jump in and reinvent the wheel, because you guys have already had to invent the wheel, unfortunately, in each of your institutions. And we should definitely just try to, you know, help you carry all those efforts forward.
So the thing I want to add is that comprehensive prevention is a real thing. And there are real things that make it comprehensive prevention. Awareness events are not comprehensive prevention, and they don't produce change. So comprehensive prevention is something that is designed to produce change. There are very specific strategies that are used in a comprehensive prevention approach to injury prevention. We talk about the continuum of prevention, primary, secondary, and tertiary, and we also talk about the social ecology. And it is engaging all of those things that needs to happen. So I think that is also something that doesn't often get talked about, that sometimes people think if we're doing awareness campaigns that that's prevention, but it doesn't tend to produce the sort of results you're hoping.
It's marketing.
I just want to say thank you all so much for joining us today, for kind of giving us at least some guidelines to keep ourselves not only out of trouble, but also hopefully contribute to this field in which, you know, we're not completely as well versed in as you guys, obviously, but would certainly love to be more involved in. I really applaud all the efforts that you have made so far, and hopefully we can contribute to them rather than subtract.
Thank you guys so much for joining us. For our listeners, if you aren't aware of some of the opportunities and engagement that you can be involved in with the Injury Control and Violence Prevention, please check out the EAST website for more information. Thank you guys all so much for joining us.
Thank you guys.
That wraps up another episode of TraumaCast, brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Visit east.org to check out all the great educational and career development resources we have to offer. And make sure you subscribe to the TraumaCast series so you don't miss any of our exciting upcoming programs or interviews. If you're searching for cutting-edge science, professional education, networking, and career development, remember, all you need to do is look to the east.